Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. My name is
Hello.
Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for a book recommendation to help me, our two high school English teachers, Ian and Joe.
Hi, Nick. Hi, wow. Ian. My name is Joe.
Here they are.
It's weird to say Joe Harvey Holeshue, because that doesn't...
Oh, that is weird.
It's weird, yeah. Joseph Harvey Holeshue. And this week I brought a book recommendation. It's actually the book that's been recommended to me most since we started recording this show.
Wow.
However, it's just been recommended to me over and over and over and over by the same person.
Uh-huh.
So this book's been recommended 70 times to me. I refuse to read it up until now, but this week brought to you by Lithead Jill. I brought Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin. Gabrielle Zevin.
Nick usually puts in a little theme. This week I'm looking for a book about whatever. I think this week is Bitterness Week, possibly. Or
that's good. Persistent Week.
Persistent Week.
Persistence pays off week.
Peace and Quiet Week.
Uh-huh.
Because after you do this, yeah, it'll be peaceful.
No. It's the opposite of Sisyphus.
Oh, okay.
Sisyphus is never going to end. And hey, Jill, if you're listening, and I know you are, it would be an incredible joke if you just went ahead and kept recommending this to Joe in today's episode. Good morning, high school English teachers. Good morning, podcasts. My name is Dr. Ian DeYoung. This week was an absolute horror show at work for me, so I didn't read a book. I'm prepared to disrupt, confuse, and otherwise bamboozle Joe's attempts at talking about this book. In advance, I will not apologize to Lithead Jill because I'm going to have fun with this, and I hope you do too.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
For all of you out there that hope you might be on the show someday, I would like to let you know that I personally extended an invitation for Jill to come on this show and talk about this book. And Nick, in his tyrannical ways, said absolutely not, under no circumstances. So, Jill, I will do my best to speak on your behalf today.
I like how you keep saying Jill as if everybody knows who that is.
She's my little sister. She's grown a lot over the years. We used to fight a lot, but now we get along better.
You fight a little bit less.
We fight less now.
I would really hope that in honor of Jill, and really to honor her memory, this week,
Jill.
She's not dead.
You just do your best Jill impersonation up to and including voice.
Oh boy. Okay, let's just move on. Let's just talk entirely to Jill like she's on the show this week, but she's not.
Silent fourth character.
Defenseless. What did you bring, Joe?
I brought a book called Tomorrow and Tomorrow Tomorrow. Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. That's going to get tricky to say.
And who wrote this?
Written by a lovely author named Gabrielle Zevin. She's written 10 books in her career, but this one, as the kids say, popped off. It went nuts. It went crazy. It was the Goodreads book of the year. It was incredibly
Goodreads
had incredibly favorable reviews from everything from New York Times to Time magazine to
that's always kind of a lot of pressure for me when I'm looking at a book and I realize everyone loved this, and there's a lot of concern at that point. Will I love it too, showing that I am smart like the smart people, or will I dislike it, revealing that I am a big dummy?
Yeah, big dummy.
Do I not get it? Am I the dummy?
What
here?
Am I not getting?
The cover of this book is incredible. The cover of this
book
incites me to read it. And I've also the fact that the...
Paint a word picture, Ian.
I don't need to paint a word picture. I can use a picture. You know that Japanese print, The Great Wave off Kanagawa?
Yes.
Yeah, you know the one. It's the big old wave.
The wave.
So the title, the cover has that on it, and then it's got the words Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow in that kind of old-fashioned-y computer script.
Like 8-bit, like 16-bit font, yeah.
But then it's also colorful, and it just, it kind of tells you, it does what a book cover is not supposed to do. It allows you to judge the book, and I judge it to be unputdownable.
All right, well, let's set the tone here, Joe. Did you like the book?
I despised it.
oh, no. So this is right away, we learned that Joe does not get what everyone else got.
Okay.
No. And I felt, and kind of like Ian saying, there's always pressure when we read a well-loved book. And this book is well-loved. It's Goodreads score, and Goodreads isn't the end-all be-all, but it has like a 4.2 on Goodreads, which is crazy high. Like,
that's really high.
Classics, yeah, like amazing books barely break the 4-star mark, if they ever do.
Yep.
4.2 is a big deal on Goodreads. Nick, can I tell you a little bit about this book?
Yeah, give us the, we already know what the front cover looks like.
Is there a big wave in the book?
Is there a back cover? Nick, this is a book about friendship. It's a book about being marginalized. It's a book about love and disability and art, failure, the redemptive power of play, and what it means to connect, to love and be loved. It's a bestseller. It's a bit of a microcultural phenomenon. Wire called it utterly absorbing. The New York Times called it delightful and absorbing and expansive and entertaining. Goodreads Book of the Year in 2022 and a 4.2 star rating, which is really, really high. I personally, Joseph Harvey Holshue, thought this book was tedious, and I could not wait to get through it.
Is it possible that just you think that just because your sister recommended it?
Well, that it may have colored my opinion.
Is there a bias at play, Joe?
Although I will say Jill is also the one that recommended that I read. Oh, what was the book? It was like the Australian, they're making a Netflix thing out of it. The guy's on the Outback, his parents are criminals. Mad Max, the book Mad Max. The book.
Furioso.
Sea of Thieves.
These are all really good guesses.
None of these. I know the one you're talking about. It was like vaguely magical realism.
Oh, Passion of the Christ 2.
Mm-hmm, yeah, Mel Gibson. I'm going to Google Australian book drugs. That's not it. Australian book drugs mentor.
You could probably just move past the specific name and get
Boy
to your point.
Swallows Universe. Boy Swallows Universe. Jill also recommended that. I thought that was a pretty good recommendation. I dug that.
Joe, are you a video gamer?
So,
because I wonder if this is a book where you kind of have to maybe not be a gamer, but maybe you have to have that background in order to love it. Because you said Wired enjoyed it, and Wired is a bunch of nerd stuff, I think.
Yeah. So, Nick, I guess for that question to have some context, I want to tell you a little bit about the plot of this book.
Yep.
So Sadie Green is a student at MIT. She's like a computer science student at MIT. Sam Mazur is an artist at Harvard. They were childhood friends. They met in a hospital where Sam was a longtime patient after a car accident basically turned his foot into jelly. And they reconnect again in Boston. They run into each other at a Boston train station, I guess like a subway stop or something like that. And Sadie has recently written a game as a class project, and she gives it to him on a 3.5-inch floppy drive to give you the sense of like when this is happening.
Classic.
She hands him a floppy drive, says, hey, we haven't seen each other. Like, check out my game, which is, I think, is the computer programming equivalent of like, check out my mixtape, right? Like,
yeah, you got to try it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, try this out.
When you say check out my mixtape, there might be some subtext to that. Like sometimes when you say check out my mixtape, it's just because you both love music, but it's also a way to establish contact with someone you're potentially
right. Or like, hey, we haven't connected to each other in a while. Like this is what I've been up to.
Joe, is this a loosely veiled sexual advance?
Well, or love. Is a love story is the other option.
Is this about pure sex, Joe?
No. In fact, it's about like the opposite of sex, which is, as we all know,
of sex?
Video games.
Video games.
2, 3.
You heard it here first, folks. Zero sum game. Either one or the other.
All men must choose.
All people, forget men. All people must choose.
No, it's
true.
At first, she's like she's like dipping him. She's like ducking him in the square. She actually sees him before he sees her. But then she like is like, Sadie, Sadie, it's me. Hey, it's me, Sadie, Sadie. Remember me? We're friends. And then she's like, oh, right. Hey. And they have some awkward small talk. And then she's like, hey, check out this video game that I made. Yeah. And he loves it. He thinks it's brilliant. They set out that summer to create a game together, and not getting too far into the book, that game is a smash hit and sets them on a career of making video games together. They have like a game studio. They make video games. Some of them are really popular. Some of them are not really popular. Some of them are like artistic masterpieces, and some of them are absolutely panned. And this book kind of follows that career and follows their changing, evolving, friendship.
Is this a book about their relationship or more about tech startups?
More their relationship, but it's kind of like 60-40. Like it's like 60% really? Relationship.
Is it a little business drama?
But then like about probably like 30% business 30%. Drama and video game 30, drama, 32%. And then 10% references to video games that you played growing up.
Oh, so this is like Ready Player One.
Okay.
How similar is this to Ready Player One?
Not similar at all. Like outside of the fact that they both have video games at their heart, it's not similar at all. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think this is one of the things that the book does well in here. The choice of video games, like the narrative thread of video games in this, feels like a good fit for the book. Like it feels like a kind of like a metaphor. Like the video games do some work in here. Like the stuff they're making games about are like the stuff that they're experiencing in their real life. In Ready Player One, video games are gratuitous references, right? Like
it's terrible, terrible analogy, Ian.
Nope.
I regret nothing.
No, in Ready Player One, video games are gratuitous references. They're just like these throwaway lines, and the entire point of them is to get the reader to be like, nope, not characters. The entire point of them is for the reader to be like, hey, I remember that game. Man, I like this book. In this book, the video games do work, right? They do work for the reader.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Video games are all about sort of engagement between creator and audience, and they're about kind of like a relationship that happens asynchronously. Like I, as a creator, make something, and then, you know, weeks, days, weeks, months, years later, somebody else plays it and we're kind of in conversation, but we're not really. Is the video game piece like a stand-in or a symbol for the relationships? Like, do we understand the relationships by means?
Obviously, Nick. Ian.
Obviously. Thank you, Nick. Yeah, yes, obviously that's what's going on. Yeah, no, like when I say the video games do work, like we see the characters mirrored in the video games that they create. We see their relationship mirrored in those video games. We see, for example, one of the video games that they create, is the concept of it is like the same character exists in two worlds, right? And it comes from this realization that Sadie has where it's like, boy, it's really weird how like sometimes you go out into the world and it feels like this like bright, open, sunny, friendly place. And sometimes you go into the world and it feels like this like really dangerous, hostile, anxiety provoking place. And the only thing that really changed is you, like your perspective, that mood, like your mood. And they create a video game that mirrors this experience where you literally toggle between these two worlds as the same character. And so like, do the video games in this book are a vehicle for discussing character. Yes.
Joe, why did you hate it so much, and why does everybody else love it so much?
So,
two good questions.
A lot of people love this book, and from what I can tell, well, I guess this is what Jill says. This is a beautiful book about friendship that transcends decades and unlikely mediums like video games. It was beautiful to see how the friends were reflected and what they were creating and how they used their games as a way of communicating with each other. And I think that's a big part of what people like about it. Other things that people like about it is...
So you think people secretly like video games?
No, I think people secretly like friendship.
Big if true. Either one, big if true.
But there's a lot of strands in this book. Like, if you asked me what this book is about, I'd be like, well, it's about friendship and it's about video games, but it's also about like creating art. And it's also about like the hardships of disability and also like immigration and otherness and marginalization. And also there's like gun violence and death and car accidents and toxic relationships and homophobia. Like, there is so much in this book that's braided together. This morning, as I was making my coffee, I was watching some interviews and reading some interviews with the author. And I thought she had a really revealing one where she said, when I wrote this book, I gave it to my partner, right? He's always my first reader. Like, I finished writing it, I gave it to my partner, and he read it and he came to me kind of teary-eyed and he said, you wrote this book for me. Like, you wrote this book for me. And she said,
uh-oh.
Well, no.
Conversations you don't want to
totally.
Have.
Totally.
Well, she's like, no, I kind of wrote it for me. And then she said, I gave it to my agent and he read it and he came to me teary-eyed and said, you wrote this book for me.
Okay.
And
she's like, who are these egotistical people is she in just your life?
Surrounded, yeah, is she surrounded by dreadful people? There's another option.
Well, and she had the same experience with her best friend. And I think
she went to the cash register at the grocery market.
Yes.
And as she was buying her own book, the cash register said, you wrote this book for me.
I didn't think I was going to ask this, but Joe, is this book about us?
Did she write this book for us?
No, it is. It's clearly 100%.
I think
crazy.
One of the reasons that people love this book so much is because I think there's a lot to connect to in it, right? And I think a lot of people read this book and they grab one of those strands, right? Like right. The struggles of being an artist, what it means to have a lifelong friend, what it means to be in love with somebody that doesn't love you back, all of these things. And they're like, hey, I connect with that. This book feels like it's for me. Like this book feels like it's telling my story.
But Joe, not being an artist or having any lifelong friends,
exactly.
has none.
I have
so I guess my question to follow up on that, Joe, is
does
sometimes you can kind of tell when a book is trying to
manipulate you.
Yeah, or it's trying to be all things to all people to offer as many handles as possible. I think to go back to my excellent example from before, Ready Player One does this by like literally throwing every pop culture reference at the wall and seeing what sticks. Saying like, mm-hmm. here are count them 8 billion references. Mm-hmm. Somebody's got to like, you got to find one you like in here. Do you get the sense that this book is trying to be massive scare quotes here? And maybe we should introduce a new thing called scorn quotes. These are scare quotes, but they're scornful. Mm-hmm. Is this trying to be universal? Is it trying to, or is it just a good story that happens to be kind of connecting to?
The first half of this book flies by, right? The first half of this book is tight. It feels efficient. It feels like it's going somewhere. The second half of this book, it feels like it maybe is trying to say too much, trying to be too many things to too many people. Like the phrase I have, like, so Nick, I hope I've put across what people like about this book. The phrase I have under the section where I say things that I found tedious is I think this book kind of collapses under its own weight, right? Like if this book was 150 pages shorter, and this is like a 420 page book, this is kind of a big boy. If it was 150 pages shorter, I think there's a pretty good book in here, right? It tries to be a lot of things. And when I say tries, that's my word. There's a whole hell of a lot of people that say like this book successfully connects to a lot of issues and successfully says things.
We've already established it's you. It's not.
It's not me. The I'm the problem. It's me. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Taylor Swift. Nice.
This book, I think, collapses under its own weight. The very first thing I had in my notes is, hey, the juice was not worth the squeeze on this, right? There's good stuff
brutal.
In here.
It oh, absolutely sorry, was Jill. Not worth it. God, that must be infuriating to hear and not be able to respond to. Jill, why is Joe so dense? Why can't he get this book? I still haven't understood why everybody loves it but you, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
Just too dense.
I have a thought.
I also have a personal vendetta against this book. It actually
Jill.
No, against Jill. Now let me talk about my sister, Jill. This book made me use up all of my audiobook minutes on Spotify for the month.
Oh,
and I
no.
didn't like
oh,
that.
Wow. To hell with this author.
And we're not that far into the month either.
No, and in the course of reading this book, I also, as we know, I do mention my reading. I'm like an e-reader, as the litheads obviously know. I broke my e-reader during this month, and I had to get a new one. And then just that title or that cover that Ian loves so much was just like staring at me, taunting me.
Joe, can I share a story and relate to you real quick?
Yes, yes, please.
I recently watched the new Dune movie in the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
Walked in, everybody, all the reviews. Oh, this is the best ever. This is the best ever. This is the best ever. I'm in it. Here comes the biggest scene of the entire movie, and the audio cuts out in the movie theater. And it just kind of ruined it for me. It had nothing to do with the movie. Yeah. Technology failed me, and it really pissed me off, and it ruined the entire experience. Do you think that maybe your Kindle, when you dropped it down the stairs, that was the real reason you didn't like the book?
No, I already disliked this book by the time that happened. I was already having a vendetta against it. Mm-hmm. No, okay. Not the tech.
So what's the overt message here, Joe? Is this the whole tension of the book is about will they or won't they, Joe? Well, or is it more of like, hey, we're going to talk about life through video games?
I think this is like...
Is it about the human experience? Or is it a...
Okay, for me, I think this is kind of the most damning piece of this story, like the most damning piece of this book. The thing to like most about this book is that it centers around a platonic friendship. And a huge amount of this book is talking about how platonic friendship is just as valuable, there's just as much beauty in it as a romantic relationship. That having a lifelong friend is a really big deal, right?
Yeah,
and that's something I can get on board with. Like, platonic friendship is absolutely a beautiful thing. I think this book kind of gets shy towards the end or something, because like late in this book, it kind of turns into a will they, won't they.
It doesn't commit to the bit.
Late in this book, we're like, oh, by the way, and then this thing happens and the one character is totally heartbroken because they were secretly in love this whole time. And
that negates everything that's come before, because I think for the difference between sort of that will they, won't they, and the platonic relationship is that the platonic relationship, as soon as it turns into will they, won't they, you kind of backfill and you always wonder, well, have I been reading this as a will they, won't they? Has this ever been about the value of platonic friendships?
Have you seen, sorry, go ahead.
I thought I'm done.
Oh, you are done. Okay, great. Now I can talk.
Great. Now it's your turn, Deck.
Has anybody watched American Fiction? No. Probably one of my favorite movies from last year. Well, it's obviously is very good. It's nominated for shit. Anyway, this is kind of how, this is one of the ways that whole movie kind of like touches on in the end. It's like, is this a love story? Is that really just, that's all it is? Is you read, you did this whole thing and it just is like, oh yeah, this is how it ends, is they fall in love or don't they? Or is that the whole point of it? So you feel like it kind of cops out in that way a little bit?
Yeah, I feel like it cops out. Like, I feel like 75% of this book is a friendship story. And then in the last quarter of this book, it's like, well, wait.
Maybe that's the point, though, Joe.
I don't think so.
No, but that's a stupid point if so, because there are such things as long-term platonic friendships. I think...
Are there?
Well, but like, Nick, this question is a troll question, but it's also motivated by like the way that the relationships are structured in media. Nowadays, kids these days, that kind of thing.
Kids like, these days.
There is no room for a platonic relationship because we always expect it to turn into this romantic thing. One of my favorite television movie films of all time, RoboCop, has a dude in it and a lady, and they are partners.
Robotic lovers.
Take care of each other, and there is zero romance whatsoever. That's not why I like it. I like it because there's amazing robots. But that's a really good example from the 1980s of like, hey, guess what? You can have people be friends without it having to turn into romance.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's super. That feels like it's super rare. And because it's super rare, we're suspicious of the platonic friendships.
When I got to the platonic love versus like romantic love towards the end, and like how that like it felt like the rug had been a little bit pulled out from me, and it was like, nope, this is something I can point to in this book and say like, I think this is bad. Like, it's this is a bad thing that happened in this book.
Not a book.
It's not the book that you thought you were reading.
Right.
I think having your expectations
hated
subverted
the ending
can be like pleasant, but when a book says good news, I am this kind of thing and I'm going to get you invested in this kind of thing, and not we're just going to give you something completely different, but we're going to give you something the opposite of what you were expecting, maybe what you enjoyed, that's exasperating.
Yeah. We really should have had Jill on to play counterpoint. Well, okay. On this episode.
Here's the thing.
Maybe one day, Jill. Maybe one day.
There's a lot of people who have said a lot of nice things about this book, so I think it's doing fine.
Yeah. It sounds like just another classic episode of I think we might be wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Many people love this book. Okay.
I mean, how could so many people be wrong, Joe?
Mm-hmm. How could?
That's never happened.
What's the quote that I'm going for? The Elvis Presley thing? Like 50 million people can't be wrong or whatever it is?
I think it's 80 billion.
80 billion people. Trillion? Yep.
I want to introduce you guys to the bird of the week.
Oh, bird of the week. Wah, wah, wah.
And this is kind of a sad bird. So like much like Joe's excitement in this book died. You guys may have heard recently that there's an eagle owl that died in New York City.
Oh yeah, everybody loved it. I've never heard of it until the news.
I was when I got the New York Times email, breaking news, Flocko is dead. I was like, what? Mm-hmm. But this is a bird. This is an eagle owl, and this bird lived in a zoo. And then eventually it was in the Central Park Zoo, and then some people cut a hole in its cage and it escaped. And then they tried to recapture it and it didn't take the bait. People were watching it and kind of cheering for it to escape. And then it just flew around outside in Central Park for about a year. It became kind of a public celebrity. And the best part about Flocko is that he would go to people's houses and look in their windows. Is what he would do.
What?
So
what you do?
Yes, I am staring at a picture tweeted by a playwright, because New York City is a place where people like playwrights live. Mm-hmm. Right, she tweeted this picture of this owl staring in a frankly creepy way into her apartment. This is from December. He was called the Peeping Tom because he would just go to people's houses and look inside.
A little perverted owl, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Doesn't know his bird boundaries.
Eventually, since, again, it's New York and everything New York has to be turned into a metaphor for New York, he was touted as the ultimate New Yorker. let me give you some of the descriptions of him. A celebrity bird. A feathered feel-good figure in troubled times, an outlaw hero who succeeded in writing a second act to his life, a symbol for freedom and resilience.
What?
He has a backstory worthy of a Walt Disney screenplay. So Flocko had
the punchline here.
A good run, and then flew into a window and died.
Oh no, Flocko.
They didn't see him fly into the window. They found him on the ground on West 89th Street, and he was dead. He probably
Waka Flocka. I bet a lot of people call them Waka Flocka.
Waka Flocka.
I bet they didn't. I bet you they called him a Peeping Tom because he would fly there. He would fly to their houses and look in their windows.
Yeah.
So
it seems like a cautionary tale. Like what brought him down was what he what he loved the most. Yeah.
It's poetic. He died what he loved doing.
Doing what
he
loved to do.
We could all be more like Waka Flocka.
My favorite part about this is that the day after Flocko died. The New York legislature passed a bill that required bird-friendly design in New York buildings statewide, and they named it the Flocko Act.
The Flocko Act. Really good.
I'm glad we're not being forgotten,
and they said partisanship ruined everything.
This has been your bird fact for the week.
Yeah, this is excellent timing. I'm glad that bird died to give us content for this show.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Joe, say something nice about the book, and then Ian, tell the litheads what to do, and then Joe, you read a quote, and then we'll do the music part.
That's perfect. Reverse Tiffany's. Welcome to Reverse Tiffany's, where I say something nice about a book that I hated. There is, I can't spoil this too much, but like,
of course,
there is a gesture of friendship in this novel towards the end that I thought was genuinely touching. It is huge. It is expansive. It is done in secret without the one friend ever wanting to know the other friend that they have done it. And it was super nice. And I thought it kind of like redeemed the idea of platonic friendship just a little bit.
But not enough for you and your high standards.
I do think the juice is not worth the squeeze, but like at the end, it kind of almost is, like it almost saves itself.
I just want to comment that we should definitely call these Reverse Tiffany's Cenafit, because that's Tiffany's backwards. And yeah, it really sounds like a wizard from a video game. So there you go.
A little over my head.
Litheads, we appreciate you. And even you, Jill, who recommended a book that Joe hated. Keep trying. Choose another book and recommend it 70 times to him. We'll repeat the process in a couple
in 2 years.
Litheads, if you would like to support and benefit our podcast, you can do that in a variety of ways. We're active on TikTok.
If you want to be treated like Jill, you can go to our website.
You can also head to our website, www.tweenvogue.com. That's TWEENVOGUE.com, where you can request books for us to read. Sometimes you can request them over and over and over. You can request stickers, you can listen to old episodes, and just generally you can bask in the bright yellow glow of our website design. Most importantly, you can tell bookish friends about what we do. Congratulations to Flocko, and congratulations to video games. Their moment in the sun has come.
All right. I have two quotes that I could read for you. One kind of explains the meaning behind the title, which we didn't talk about, but is obviously an allusion to Macbeth. And you might be wondering, what do video games have to do with Macbeth? And there's like a passage that explains it. But my actual favorite thing in this entire book was in the author's acknowledgments at the very end of the book. I always really love reading the author's acknowledgments and thanks and seeing the many people who helped them on the way. And the very last line, she says, "My books can be divided into dog eras. Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow was begun in the era of Edie and Frank. It was completed in the era of Leia and Frank. Good dogs all."
That was it? That was a quote?
That's it. That's done.
That all happened very quickly.
Yeah. I can read the soliloquy from Shakespeare if you really want.
You have it in front of you?
I do.
Read it.
This is from the part of Macbeth where the king Macbeth realizes he's gonna die. "Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.